From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. When it comes to the economy, slow growth may be better than no growth, but that doesn't mean it makes people happy. In the first part of this year, the economy expanded at a tepid pace, just under 2%. That's well below the average for the last half century, 3% growth per year.
Some influential analysts are saying that we're in for a new normal, 2% growth, not 3. 1 percentage point may not seem like much, but as NPR's John Itzty reports, the difference is huge.
The new normal is a term coined by the brain trust at the giant bond fund PIMCO. Anthony Crescenzi, a PIMCO vice president, strategist, and portfolio manager, is part of that brain trust.
The difference between 2% growth and 3% growth is of major importance and has major implications for the entire economy, for financial markets, for the budget.
And the heart of the problem is job creation. Crescenzi and his colleagues argue that the U.S. economy could actually grow 2% a year without adding any new jobs. That's because the productivity of current workers is rising at about 2% a year.
In other words, a company can produce 2% more goods and or services per year, even if it does not increase the amount of people it employs.
Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, thinks some new jobs would be added in an economy growing 2% a year, but far fewer than in one growing 3%.
In a 3% world, we'd create roughly 1.6 million jobs per year.
In a 2% world, he says, job creation would be less than half that, around 700,000 jobs.
That would not be enough to absorb the increase in the labor force each year, and therefore the unemployment rate would rise.
Zandi estimates it would rise 0.25% a year and in less than 5 years be back in double digits. In 10 years, the unemployment rate would be close to 12%. Of course, that means many of the workers sidelined during the recent recession would remain out of work. Incomes would also be affected. Zandi estimates that in a 2% world, the average household income would increase $17,000 less over a decade than it would in a world of 3% growth. For a family that's car shopping, that's the difference between the price of a Hyundai Compact and a Lexus sports sedan. And says PIMCO's Tony Crescenzi, U.S. auto sales, which were over 16 million vehicles a year before the financial crisis, have declined substantially in a 2% world.
These days, because of high unemployment, plus the lack of credit availability, car sales are running at a 12 to 13 million annualized rate. That's a new normal.
The higher levels of unemployment in a 2% growth world would make government budget problems much worse. People without jobs and incomes don't pay income taxes. They also purchase fewer goods and services, meaning less sales tax revenue for state and local governments. Crescenzi says if the economy continues to grow at a 2% annual rate, federal budget deficits would hover where they are right now, at about 10% of GDP, a dangerous and unsustainable level, and twice what they'd be if the economy were growing at 3% a year. Mark Zandi also cautions that with 2% growth, the U.S. could easily be pushed back into recession by events like an oil price spike or Europe's debt crisis. And he says even 3% growth isn't enough cushion.
We really need to see growth that is closer to 4% for a couple, 3 years, get that unemployment rate down. And then the risks of falling back into recession would be a lot lower.
Zandi is actually predicting growth close to 4% next year and the year after, and he cautions against too much pessimism about the future.
We've been through things like this in our history, and we've always overcome them. So I would counsel against expecting the world to look 5, 10 years from now the way it looks today. I think our prospects are much brighter than that.
But the PIMCO Brain Trust believes the new normal could easily last for 5 more years. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
And more on the new normal tomorrow on Morning Edition. NPR's Wendy Kaufman examines whether our real problem is a slowdown in the pace of innovation. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. People who care about the National Football League are watching closely for any clues about negotiations between players and owners. And the tea leaf reading is especially intense in such places as St. Joseph, Missouri, and Mankato, Minnesota. That's because they host lucrative NFL summer training camps. Some teams have already canceled their camps. And as Greg Eklund reports, with the NFL lockout dragging on, St. Joseph and Mankato fear that this is the year that their teams won't be coming to town.
It was just 1 year ago that the NCAA Division II softball championship was held on this softball field in St. Joseph, Missouri. It's now underwater, submerged by the flooding Missouri River. Last year, sports events were on a roll for St. Joseph. It was about to host Chiefs training camp for the first time, and the Chiefs are scheduled to return later this month. The flood this summer has forced tournaments on this softball field to be canceled. The last thing community leaders here want is the possibility of Chiefs training camp to be in jeopardy because of the lockout.
As a hotelier, I can say we need the revenue, so it would be fantastic if they would get this figured out.
That's Chris Boer, the general manager of a hotel within sight of the Chiefs' indoor training facility. She's also frank about her feelings toward the Chiefs.
As a fan, I can't even imagine, I can't even fathom not having football this fall. It's disheartening.
Missouri Western University economist Patrick McMurray says a summer without Chiefs training camp would make a significant dent in the economy here. His economic impact study showed visitors spent $1.2 million last year in St. Joe.
We had somebody at the Chiefs camp who lives several states away, and they said they're going to keep coming back. This is what they're going to do with their kids, is come back. And so there's a snowball effect. The results from the first one were enormously positive. You don't want to let the air out of that balloon.
Further north, the Minnesota Vikings have trained on the campus of Minnesota State University in Mankato since 1966. Jake's Pizza Stadium, across the street from the campus, has seen its share of fans and players through the years. Restaurant owner Wally Boyer says if the Vikings are a no-show, it would leave a considerable void here.
It would have an effect on our business, and not only that, but just the feeling around Mankato in general, that the Vikings come here every year, and it's a fun thing, and it brings a lot of people to town, and it means a lot for the whole community, really. And it does mean something for us, too, but it's huge for this area.
The Vikings have announced that if a labor agreement isn't reached by next Monday, the team will forego plans to train in Mankato this summer. It's crunch time across the country in towns like Latrobe, Pennsylvania, Anderson, Indiana, and Georgetown, Kentucky, where fans and officials are closely monitoring the NFL labor talks. They're waiting to see if their favorite team will show up to practice. For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund.
We're going to hear now about a controversial innovation in the energy industry. It's called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking for short. It's created a drilling boom for natural gas and oil from Texas to Pennsylvania, and it may also be polluting drinking water. Today, a U.S. Energy Department committee will discuss how to make fracking safer. NPR's Jeff Brady reports on an issue that has overshadowed much of the wider debate over energy.
In the U.S., pretty much all the oil and gas that was easy to get to is gone. Fracking makes it possible to extract petroleum a mile underground in dense layers of shale. Drillers pump truckloads of water mixed with sand and chemicals into the rock. Under intense pressure, that creates tiny fractures that allow oil and gas trapped there to escape.
Hydraulic fracturing is truly the rocket science of what's happening in energy.
Tisha Connolly-Schuler heads the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, and she's seen fracking bring new life to old oil and natural gas fields. She says domestic production is a good thing, especially of natural gas, because it burns cleaner. Fracking has made natural gas more abundant and relatively cheap at a time the U.S. needs reliable and affordable sources of energy. In Pennsylvania, the number of natural gas wells drilled into the Marcellus Shale has increased from a few dozen in 2007 to more than 1,400 last year. Drive around the region and you'll see that not everyone shares the industry's fascination with fracking. There are lawn signs opposing gas drilling and even a homemade sign reading, "Thou shalt not frack." Many of these folks were inspired by a movie last year called Gasland. It included this scene of a man in Colorado holding a lighter next to a faucet.
We'll just give it a second here.
Then the water itself catches fire.
Whoa, Jesus.
Nearby drilling is blamed, and throughout the movie, filmmaker Josh Fox gives fracking special attention, calling into question how safe it is and whether it's adequately regulated. All the focus on fracking worries the petroleum industry. Tisha Connolly-Shuler says the term fracking now means more than just the process of fracturing shale to get at oil and gas.
I think hydraulic fracturing has become a synonym for oil and gas development, or anything that one doesn't like about oil and gas development.
The industry worries that could prompt policymakers to restrict fracking and bring a halt to the gas booms underway. That's already happening in cities around the country: Buffalo, New York, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and most recently, Morgantown, West Virginia. New York State is deciding on new rules to govern fracking there. And it's not just industry concerned about the focus on fracking. Some environmentalists say it may be taking attention away from other problems that go along with drilling, like air pollution and toxic spills. Amy Mall with the Natural Resources Defense Council says one good thing about the fracking issue is all the attention it's brought to oil and gas production.
I'm hoping that it's really just a starting point, a jumping off point, to look at all these other issues.
Mall says ideally the focus on fracking will lead to more research about how oil and gas development affects people.
There's very little science about any of these impacts, not just the fracking, but the air quality, the waste management issues. And we really need a lot more attention to all of these, but it does seem in the immediate priority of the agencies is to focus on fracking.
Certainly, that's what the Energy Department's Natural Gas Subcommittee will discuss this morning. Eventually, the recommendations will be sent to the federal agencies who have a role in regulating fracking. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Now, a new novel, which takes as its backdrop the partition of India. In 1947, the modern-day India and Pakistan were born. Partitions, by Amit Mujumdar, explores the tumultuous time when that happened. Alan Chews has our review.
The metaphor suggested by the title, Partitions, produces quite a lot of ironic juxtapositions of characters and states of mind and body. India, Pakistan, Hindu, Muslim, the young and the old, the good and the venal, families and solitude, the living and the dead. The narrator, a Hindu pulmonologist, has died of a bad heart just before he begins telling the story. In the tumultuous world of the partition, he can make no more than a blur or a breeze in the face of the living, but he still tries desperately to guard the lives of his two young sons. One of them also has a heart problem. Both brothers are separated from their mother as they cross from Pakistan into India. While another physician, an elderly Muslim doctor, carrying only his black bag and a heavy heart, walks from India toward the new border with Pakistan. The crowds among whom these travelers move number in the millions. The writer chooses the lyric path rather than the epic way. He switches back and forth in short takes about the boys' struggle to rejoin their mother in their journey, about the vile actions of a trio of human traffickers, about the Muslim doctor's dangerous pilgrimage. Rather than producing a sweeping narrative about the partition, this adds up to a narrowly focused book that generates deep emotion about the difficulties of a small group of characters over a brief period of time. At one point in the story, Dr. Masood meets up with the sons of the ghostly narrator and leans down to listen to the chest of the boy with the heart problem. So close to the boy's heart, he thinks, just an inch, but unreachable. This first-time novelist has helped us to travel that brief but crucial distance from words on the page to dreams in our minds and hearts, and made this bitter, brutal time somehow reachable.
The book is Partitions by Amit Mujumdar. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
This is NPR.
Susan B. Anthony became the first woman on a dollar coin. In the 19th century, she fought for the right of American women to vote. But her friend, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, was at least as significant. Her demands for women's rights were more sweeping. In fact, one of her biographers, Laurie Ginsburg, says Stanton raced from one issue to another. She was a radical thinker.
You know, I think reform movements need both radical thinkers and strategists. And if she wanted to have a career where she was on a coin and remembered for accomplishing a particular goal, then yeah, we could say she sabotaged herself.
But let's look this morning at the influential woman who did not end up on a dollar coin. We've been hearing new interpretations of the 1800s, a century that shaped our nation. Lori Ginsberg says Elizabeth Cady Stanton deeply influenced women's rights as we talk of them today, even though she didn't really fight for all women.
She certainly claimed that she fought for the rights of all women. She fought to end the barriers that denied American citizens their rights purely on the basis of sex. And she demanded rights that not one of us would be willing to give up. I mean, she demanded access to, in the true liberal tradition, access to the mainstream of American society in terms of professions, education, law, politics, property, and so on. But when she said women, I think, and I argue this in the book, that she primarily had in mind women much like herself, white, middle class, culturally, if not religiously Protestant, propertied, well-educated. And my disagreement with Stanton is that she came to phrase women too as women first and came to see women like herself as more deserving of rights than other people.
Wait a minute. What do you mean women first? What does that mean as opposed to women too?
In the post-Civil War period when there was a battle among abolitionists, of which Stanton counted herself, between having a 15th Amendment that gave black men the vote or holding out for a suffrage amendment that granted the vote to all adult Americans, Stanton and her friend Susan B. Anthony stood on what they claimed was the highest moral ground by demanding universal rights for all and not being willing, historians have argued about this ever since, not being willing to sacrifice women's rights for the politically expedient challenge of gaining rights for black men. Except that she didn't just stand on the moral high ground. She also descended to some rather ugly racist rhetoric along the lines of, we, educated, virtuous white women, are more worthy of the vote.
Let's reconstruct the historical moment here. The Civil War was fought, of course, and the slaves were ultimately freed at the end of the war. African Americans were granted full citizenship through changes in the Constitution. The question was what was going to happen with women, and she wasn't happy taking a back seat to African Americans.
Well, I would phrase that somewhat differently, if I may. African American men were granted the rights of citizens, and African American women, of course, weren't. And there were differences among abolitionists in the North about this. Do we hold out for the, as I say, the fullest possible suffrage for all adult Americans, or do we, in the current emergency, with terrible news of racist violence coming north, do we give the black community in some form the voting rights that we're able to gain for them in the current political climate? And it's a political fight that we can, many of us, relate to. Do we hold out for the biggest possible thing, or do we recognize the emergency of the moment and get rights or the tool of political power for whatever groups we can? But Stanton didn't just stay on the moral high ground. Instead, she talked about how much worse black men would be as voters than the white women about whom she was concerned. And she was really quite dismissive of black women's claims.
She even argued that, if I'm not mistaken, that it could be harmful to women to allow themselves to be placed under, in some sense, the rule of black men, were black men to be given the vote.
Yeah, there are some comments about what will we and our daughters suffer if these degraded black men are allowed to have the rights that would make them even worse than our Saxon fathers. She has one, I think, inexplicable comment about black women would find an even worse slavery under black men than they did under their former white slave owners, which is not a comment that she got from any black woman.
You know, it's amazing to think about the different minefields that Elizabeth Cady Stanton could step in here, and also the different dividing lines in society. It wasn't just men and women. It was also upper class versus lower class. There were questions of race. There were questions of religion, questions of every kind.
Well, that's why when people talk about Stanton and women's rights and her devotion to women, my first question is always, which women? You know, what are the issues here? Which women are we talking about? Whose concerns are going to take priority? And then along the way, and this is where my disagreement with Stanton, of course, is strongest, along the way, whose rights are you going to put down in the process of demanding your own?
Do you see any modern parallels of this?
Well, I think that there's modern implications to this. I mean, I think that that Stanton helped create a rhetoric or a political ideology where when we say women, and often when the media says women, in terms of feminist goals, we think middle-class white women. It's never been the case that the contemporary women's movement was all white or middle-class. This kind of arrogance in assuming that you can declare which are the women's rights issues of an age has always struck me as an ongoing problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the obvious analogy that's been raised to me many times when I've spoken about this book is the one between in the 2008 presidential primary when Clinton and Obama were running against each other, and there was a lot of people saying, who should be president first, a woman or an African American? That's where I say it's a false dichotomy to continue to describe women's rights as represented by this white woman. Not saying that Clinton did that, but the media often did that. And black civil rights as represented by a black man. There's a more complicated way to talk about that.
Laurie Ginsberg is the author of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, An American Life.
This week, as the U.S. Space Shuttle program draws to a close, we've been taking a look at some highlights from past missions in a series we are calling Flying High, the first in their class. Yesterday, we talked with Dr. Bernard Harris, a flight surgeon who in 1995 became the first African-American to walk in space. Today, we are talking about another famous first. In 1985, Space Shuttle Discovery left Kennedy Space Center.
3, 2, 1. We have booster ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of Discovery, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
During the week-long mission, the astronauts aboard would launch and retrieve a number of satellites, and they would also participate in the first test of the Star Wars missile defense system. NBC News coverage at the time also made a point that this trip would be significant for another reason.
On board, and what makes this particular mission notable, are two foreign astronauts. One, Patrick Baudry from France. The other is Sultan Salman Al Saud, who's a Saudi prince, a 28-year-old Saudi prince.
On that day in June 1985, His Royal Highness Prince Sultan bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud of Saudi Arabia became the first Arab, the first Muslim, and the first member of a royal family to fly into space. And His Royal Highness is now the president of the Saudi Commission for Tourism and Antiquities, and he's with us on the line now from Spain, where he is traveling. Your Royal Highness, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's our great pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As we mentioned, you were the first Arab, first Muslim, and the first member of a royal family to fly into space. Of those three things, which was the most significant to you?
Well, the flight itself, in fact, I wasn't paying attention too much to the titles, but that added an extra responsibility, especially the part about representing this part of the world, the Arab world and the Islamic world. And that basically was the most significant part.
You have an interesting background. You have multiple qualifications. You're not only a pilot, you also have a master's in social and political science. Why did you want to make this trip?
Well, I was those days working at the Information Ministry in Saudi Arabia, and they were recruiting for a mission that was offered by NASA. NASA was competing those days, I imagine, with the European Space Agency. One of the ways to get more satellites to fly on the space shuttle was to offer a seat, let's say, a payload specialist seat on the shuttle. So it was very interesting for many countries, Mexico, India, Japan, and many other countries. Saudi Arabia was chosen because it was a founding member of the Arab Satellite Organization, which is basically a multi-government organization that launches satellites and still does. They wanted to recruit from both the military and civilian population in Saudi, and 20 of us were basically asked to join. To me, it was really those days a far-fetched idea, if you like. I was pretty much enjoying, like I am now, enjoying the flying part and, you know, making that into a central part of my life. But, you know, sometimes fate basically directs things in a direction that you never imagined, and it was a tremendous opportunity.
One of the aspects of space travel that I think people find fascinating is how astronauts cope with the routines of daily life, be it eating or brushing their teeth. And traditionally, Muslims are required to pray 5 times a day. How did you address this responsibility while in space?
Very easily, because we have been acclimated, whether from a religious point of view or whether from just a personal point of view. I myself have grown up in the central part of Arabia, and we are surrounded by great deserts, and of course, I'm a diver also at the same time, and I'm a flyer, and I'm a glider pilot. And in doing all these things at the same time, they become natural when you work on them and practice them. We never really saw Islam or religious duties as being something out of the ordinary. I remember, you know, whether we're flying or in different places as a Muslim, you can pray anytime, you can face any direction, like in a space shuttle, you know. We can't really face to Mecca, although we're flying east. because we're flying at such a great speed. Like I said, those days, by the time you face Mecca, you probably already passed it. So you know, in fact, also...
So what did you do? Just stop? How did you manage? You couldn't have a rug, I presume. You couldn't have a prayer rug.
No rug. No magic flying rug.
No.
But, you know, I had to strap my feet so I can kneel. You know, you can't kneel fully because lack of gravity, actually. But, you know, I prayed like a traveler. As travelers, we pray three times a day, not five times a day. And I prayed according to Florida time when we launched. And in fact, it was the end of the fasting month, which is approaching now, as you know, in about 3 weeks. And we did fast the whole month of Ramadan in Houston on Clear Lake. And we, in fact, NASA people were very kind enough to say if we wanted to adjust our program to start a bit later, we said we'll start exactly the same time we started every day, which is about 6:30 or 7 in the morning. It was hot in the summer those days, like these days. And we went on through the day and had laid more than 5 or 6 hours sleep, and we were never the healthiest. So the last day of the mission was actually the last day of Ramadan also. So I also was the first person to fast a day of the month of Ramadan in space.
Okay. Yesterday, as I mentioned, we spoke with Dr. Bernard Harris, who on his second mission became the first African-American to walk in space. But he also talked to us about being part of the space shuttle mission to Russia's Mir space station. And he talked about the importance of that international collaboration in space. I want to just ask if you had some thoughts about that.
Definitely. I think space is a unifier in science and technology. And when people join venture in doing good things, it's always a good thing for planet Earth and people of the planet Earth. I believe that we were actually hoping after the space mission, we had those talks being already advanced to fly somebody every 2 years, a 10-year program, 5 missions to the space station, and put more scientists. We were that enthusiastic. But, you know, the Challenger accident came and sort of derailed things a little bit. When I met with late President Reagan in the end of 85, he was very enthusiastic about continuing to joint venture on science and technology. And we have made great strides in Saudi in the areas of science and technology and knowledge building for the young generations. I think that humans need to find more and more things that unite them. And doing things together like these are very important to continue.
You know what I forgot to ask you? Was it fun?
Oh, what do you expect me to say?
I don't know. I've never been there.
I'll tell you, the question that people ask me was, it's scary. And I tell people that I was just having so much fun, I forgot what scary was. And, you know, I was young enough and maybe not so wise that all I was thinking about is the experience. I imagine every single person that's flown in space would tell you there was not a scary moment in that whole episode.
His Royal Highness Prince Sultan bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud was a payload specialist on STS-51G, a flight of the space shuttle Discovery in June of 1985. We caught up with him in Spain. Your Royal Highness, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
If you'd like to listen to our interview with Dr. Bernard Harris, the first in our series, Flying High, the first in their class, just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. Tomorrow, we continue this series with the first Latina in space, Ellen Ochoa.